Welcome back, listeners, to another edition of the Built on the Border podcast. I'm Tom Randolph, here with my co-host, Mr. Tommy Watson. Tommy, Monday, June 22nd. How you doing?
Pretty good. I'm real excited to get going with the show. I feel like we got a ton of stuff to talk
about this week. Yeah, there's a lot happened this past week, and we'll go ahead and get started jumping into the NBA Finals. Those wrapped up last week. The Golden State Warriors winning their first title in 40 years. The last time they won was in 1975, defeating the heavily unmanned Cleveland Cavaliers. They were the Cavs were hurting a little bit in the injury department, and the Warriors were able to win in six games. What was your overall reaction to the series? I mean, it was an entertaining series at times. Other times, it felt like the Warriors almost had complete control and were in the driver's seat. What were your thoughts after the Warriors' team performance?
Well, I was glad to see the Warriors finally get a championship again. You know, as being a Royals fan and not getting a championship for the last 29 years, kind of relate to how they go 40 years without one.
Right.
But my impression from the series was basically it was the Warriors versus LeBron James.
Right.
I noticed in many of the games, LeBron would come down, he would make spectacular plays, and then the Warriors would come down the other way, answer by just a couple easy passes, and someone would hit a wide-open shot. You know, the Cavs were able to keep up a lot of times, but it was mostly LeBron doing the work.
I think you had a case of the best player against the best team.
Yeah.
And in that situation, you know, anyone who's participated in a team sport knows you can't just do it with one guy. And the Cavaliers weren't trying to do that this year. They brought in Kevin Love. They had Kyrie Irving already, who was an all-star, one of the best young point guards in the league. So the fact that they were so heavily unmanned for this series, I think, really hurt the Cavaliers. The other thing that I think was hurting the Cavaliers, and the story came out from Mark Stein earlier this week, is LeBron James' demeanor towards his head coach, David Blatt. We've been hearing some criticism from both Mark Stein of ESPN and Brian Windhorst, who has been following LeBron James throughout his entire career, discussing the fact that there were times where they used the word emasculated to describe the way LeBron James was treating his head coach David Blatt on the sideline. You know, we've had times where we haven't liked the way that, you know, managers or coaches in Kansas City have coached a game and players have showed their displeasure. You know, we've had coaches that we've played for before, you know, in high school and when we were younger that we didn't necessarily agree with the way they coached, but you don't handle that by disrespecting them and emasculating them. And there are points in the series where LeBron James would literally tell David Blatt no and have him write up a new play. What are your thoughts on kind of the speculation on how LeBron James was treating his head coach David Blatt? And is LeBron James' talent so great that he gets away with it? Should he be able to get away with that kind of behavior?
I kind of have mixed feelings on it because I feel like the NBA as a whole is probably one of the easier sports to kind of disregard a head coach. Like, you don't want to disregard a head coach. They're there for a reason. They're paid for a reason. But I feel like so much relies on the talent of the players that sometimes they can get away with just disregarding the head coach.
Right. Well, you know, I'm sure there were times in Kobe Bryant's career where he disagreed with the way that Phil Jackson coached. I'm sure there are times in Tim Duncan's career where he hasn't necessarily been on the same page with Greg Popovich. I'm positive there were times where Michael Jordan didn't agree with how his coaches handled him, his minutes, or the game plan. But they never did it publicly. They never disrespected their coach on the bench. You never saw them, you know, throw tantrums or just blatantly tell their coach no. This is behavior that's kind of new because I think no matter how much those other players I just mentioned didn't agree with the coach, they had enough respect to not be disrespectful and blatantly err on the opposite side of their head coach. In this instance, David Blatt is a rookie head coach in the NBA terms, but he has a lot of experience. He coached overseas and won overseas championships. To have LeBron James, who is the greatest player alive right now, you know, greatest player actively playing right now, best player in the world, to treat David Blatt with such utter disregard for his coaching experience, complete lack of respect, I think this is yet another blemish on LeBron James' legacy where people can point to this and say, look, he is undoubtedly one of the best talents to ever grace an NBA court. But in terms of the entire package, he can't be the greatest player of all time because of certain things, and I think this falls into one of those categories. I think LeBron is almost uncoachable at times. I think one of the few people that's been able to actually coach him was Eric Spoelstra in Miami, but that was because LeBron James was not the guy when he went to Miami. He was coming into a situation where there already was an established presence. Eric Spoelstra had already been coaching the team, and Dwayne was there. So there was a certain level of accountability LeBron James had to adhere to. He could move back to Cleveland, and this is now his team again. I still don't think that that gives him the right to disrespect Blatt the way that he did, or the way that he reportedly did. And I think the Cavaliers have a tough decision to make, because do you keep David Blatt? Do you try and keep your superstar happy? Or do you leave him in that role and just hope that the relationship gets better over time? And I don't know, after everything that's happened, that it does. I don't necessarily think that Blatt's a great coach, but he's won championships overseas. He's won championships, not, I think, you know, not in the, NBA, at the NBA level, but I think it gives him enough validation that he has earned that respect. And you know what? LeBron did carry this team, but David Blatt had to do a hell of a coaching job to get them as far as they did without Kevin Love, and then get them as far as they did without Kyrie Irving, because that defensive scheme they had going in the first three games of the series were the only reasons that they were even able to get up a game on the Warriors. So I think that the Cavaliers organization has a lot of soul-searching to do. I think that LeBron James has a lot of soul-searching to do to figure out, can he go back to being a player who is coachable and will listen to an authority figure? And I think maybe David Blatt has a lot of soul-searching to do. Is this how he wants his career in the NBA to go, to consistently have to play second fiddle to your player? He's in charge, but he's constantly being relegated to second in command as long as LeBron James continues to disrespect it, you know, how he coaches the game. So those are my thoughts on it. You know, I don't want to get too far away from talking about Golden State, because I was really impressed by what they did in the finals. I was super impressed with how they played as a team. Steve Kerr made seemingly all the right moves in terms of personnel decisions and when to play guys. And as a result, Andre Iguodala, who wasn't even a starter for the Warriors until the finals this season, comes with the finals MVP. What does it say about team basketball kind of being back in the spotlight when Andre Iguodala wins the finals MVP? What did that tell you about this team?
I thought it was real interesting how it showed that teamwork could show how the best player from this year, Steph Curry, the MVP, was able to not, I wouldn't say he wouldn't take a backseat, because Andre Iguodala did not outperform him significantly or anything. Right. He just was consistently good, whereas Steph Curry was a little up and down, and he provided more of a consistent backbone effort for this finals run for the Warriors.
Yeah, and I think it showed that this team, what makes them so special is that they can plug guys. You know, they go almost 10 deep when you think about it. I mean, and guys are willing to sacrifice minutes and playing time for the sake of the team. You know, Andrew Bogut played significantly less minutes in these finals than he was used to during the regular season. David Lee didn't play very much during the finals until they actually really needed him. Andre Iguodala was able to step up and play, but you had guys that were benched really for the first time all season, that being Andrew Bogut, for the sake of winning. And I think that's really special. I think Andre Iguodala winning the finals MVP spoke volumes to how crucial true team play is in the NBA these days. True team-oriented squads are going to be the ones that you see coming out on top, whether that was the Spurs last year. Really, if you look at the Mavs and the Heat, you know, the last two teams to win it besides those organizations, they really played a united sense of basketball. There wasn't really one guy that was a superstar that kind of carried everybody. You had a lot of people contributing in different supporting roles, and I think that kind of culminated in the type of season the Warriors had. Because if you look at them on paper, they are historically one of the greatest teams from a win-loss perspective. There are only two teams to ever have more combined regular season and playoff wins than this Golden State Warriors team, and those were two of the Michael Jordan Chicago Bulls teams. So that says a lot about what they were able to do, how they were able to do it, and how dominant the Warriors were during the 2014-2015 season. I gotta, you know, take my hat off to them. It was a really impressive finals performance. I think they really won over the majority of the country with the way that they played. Sticking with the NBA theme, though, this Thursday night we have the NBA draft. There is not a high amount of Kansas talent in this draft that we were used to from last year, with Andrew Wiggins and Joel Embiid to being selected with the number 1 and the number 3 pick. But KU does have two guys, Kelly Oubre and Cliff Alexander that are projected to go at some point on Thursday night. Oubre projected to potentially go in the lottery. I could see him falling somewhere between 15 and 20, but I don't see him falling much out of that. He will be a first-round pick. And then Cliff Alexander is kind of a mystery. We don't really know where he may end up on Thursday night. But I did want to kind of just talk about the draft a little bit. I'm going to release a story, you know, probably tomorrow or Wednesday, about how I think the draft's going to go, which guys are good fits. But I did want to just touch on the top five. The top five order of the lottery this year will be the Timberwolves picking first, the Lakers second, 76ers third, Knicks unfortunately picking fourth, and then the Orlando Magic picking fifth. First of all, not a great lottery for the New York Knicks, who were really hoping to be contending for that number one overall pick. Now they're relegated to number four, with the Lakers sneaking in to take the number two pick. So it's safe to assume that the Minnesota Timberwolves will take Karl Anthony Towns with the number one pick. So at two, considering the talent that's on the board, then you're the Lakers. You've got the uber offensively gifted big man, Jahlil Okafor. You've got the kind of enigmatic athletic point guard in Emmanuel Mudiay, who was going to play at SMU for Larry Brown, decided to play in China for a year. You've got D'Angelo Russell, and we saw what he was capable of doing with the Ohio State Buckeyes. And then you've got two European guys we don't know much about, and Kristaps Porzingis, sorry, I can never say that name, and Mario Hezonja. So who do you see the Lakers taking with that number two overall pick?
Well, my inside sources with the Lakers, a.k.a. the internet, I looked at a couple things, and it seems like they are fairly set on Jahlil Okafor. They see him as the center of the future for them, so I think he's kind of solidly in there for their pick.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting to consider a future where, you know, Julius Randle, his rookie season was cut significantly short last year with a broken leg. Imagining him and Jahlil Okafor playing the four and the five for that team, I mean, that's a really great 1-2 punch if you consider how much these guys are going to develop over the, or you would hope they would develop over the next couple seasons. So that's a really intriguing prospect for the Lakers, and I think it would put them in the right direction. There's also rumors right now that the Lakers are trying to package some sort of deal to acquire DeMarcus Cousins. So if that's the case, maybe they go in a little different direction than Jahlil Okafor. I'd have to imagine that if that trade does go through, that this number two pick would be included. That would probably go to the Kings. So who knows? We may even see Jahlil Okafor in a Kings jersey on Thursday night, but we're not quite sure. Next, with a third pick, are the Philadelphia 76ers. And as we talked last week, they're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place because they don't really know what the future health holds for what they hope to be the future cornerstone of the franchise, Joel Embiid. There's been some talk about D'Angelo Russell going number three to 76ers. There's also reports that he said he doesn't want to play for Philadelphia. And if I was a young player, I probably wouldn't want to be a part of a rebuilding project that has basically been going on for about the past four or five seasons. Who do you see coming off the board at number three?
I think they'll stick with D'Angelo Russell.
You think so?
Yeah,
I like that idea, but if I'm the 76ers, I don't know that they would necessarily take Russell because of his commitment and what he said openly about playing for the 76ers. Maybe he didn't say it, but maybe somebody in his circle did. I think that the 76ers are likely to take a chance on Emmanuel Mudiay out of China, who, is, as we know, is going to play for Larry Brown at SMU. And the reason I say that is that that's the point guard position is a position of need for them. Like a lot of positions for the 76ers, they really need to fill it with an explosive athlete, and I think Mudiay kind of fits that mold of a Russell Westbrook or a Derrick Rose style point guard. So I think he fills a need there. And then the Knicks get their guy with D'Angelo Russell with the number four pick. I think that's a really perfect marriage for those two.
So why do you think that's a perfect marriage for them?
Well, because you look at the Knicks, and they're kind of like the 76ers. They need everything. Besides a scoring forward, they really need everything. And I think that the Knicks are also trying to explore the possibility of trading their pick, one of their guys is off the board at four. So, you know, if they don't take Russell with number four, they trade down. But I think Russell will still be there at number four because I don't think he really fits the mold of what the Philadelphia 76ers are trying to do. And like I said, I don't really think they're going to take a chance on a guy who has maybe indicated he doesn't want to play for them. But also because I think Russell would be perfect for that triangle offense that Phil Jackson tries to run in New York. D'Angelo Russell is a great defender, but I also think that his length and his athleticism will fit that system really well. And then the number five pick is kind of hazy. It's the Orlando Magic, who are kind of an enigma because they've got a lot of talent in certain places. They've got Victor Oladipo, who's clearly a future cornerstone. They've got Elfrid Payton, who they're waiting to develop. They have Aaron Gordon, who was the explosive forward out of Arizona last year, who's still developing an offensive game. He's still one of the youngest players in the NBA. And then you have Nikola Vucevic, who is a really talented center. He is one of those guys who can average 20 and 10. And then, the Magic, you wonder if they'll be able to re-sign Tobias Harris or what the future of Maurice Harkless is. So those raise a lot of questions. So the Magic really have the opportunity to take the best player available. And I err on the side of caution when it comes to saying that teams should draft these EuroLeague guys, because I don't doubt that they can end up being outstanding players. You look at a guy like Dirk Nowitzki or Jonas Valanciunas. They end up being really, really talented big men in the NBA. But then there's also other cases where you have Darko Milicic. So while I would like to say that maybe they'll take Porzingis with the number five pick, or they'll take Hezonja out of Croatia with the number five pick, I think they're going to go with the best player available, the most proven player available. And he was my favorite player to watch during the NCAA tournament, and that's Justice Winslow out of Duke. I just think physically he's the most gifted athlete still left on the board. He can shoot, he can stretch, he can really spread the floor, and he can play really anywhere from the one to the four position, and that's why I think the Magic take him with the number five pick. So those will be the only picks that we released tonight. We'll talk a little bit more about it in the article I'm going to write tomorrow about how this draft is going to shake out, and I'll cover all 30 picks of the first round, and if I have time, I'll try and get to the second round as well. But we'll move away from the draft now, and we're going to talk Blackhawks winning the Stanley Cup, because it was a big moment for the city of Chicago. It's their third Stanley Cup in six seasons. They defeated the Tampa Bay Lightning, who have been a really solid team in the past decade themselves. So now the last five NHL Stanley Cup winners are the Chicago Blackhawks or the LA Kings. I've heard a lot of talk about this Blackhawks team being a dynasty. I don't really want to talk about the results of the Stanley Cup final, but I do want to talk about what constitutes a dynasty. Does winning once every other year constitute a dynasty? You're kind of like that one every other, like the San Francisco Giants do? Or do you have to win consecutive titles? And to correct myself, the last three teams to win a Stanley Cup are the Blackhawks, Bruins, and the LA Kings. But of the majority of those six cups, the Kings have two, and the Blackhawks have three, and the Bruins have one in the last six seasons. So back to my question. Does three Stanley Cups in six seasons constitute a dynasty?
I think it does, because I've always considered in most sports that over a 5 to 6 year period, which I consider the minimum term you need to start considering a team a dynasty, that if you win half the championships or more, that's considered a dynasty. So the Kings have won three of the last six. Some other examples I looked up were in the NBA. I believe the Spurs did about the same thing they did in every other in the mid-2000s.
Right.
The Lakers, in the beginning of the 2000s, they won three in a row.
Right.
And I know my Cornhuskers in the mid-90s managed to win three out of five, too.
But they had won consecutive championships,
yeah,
right, at some point. That's the issue that I take. The Spurs have been able to keep it up for for almost 15 years. They've been able to keep up this level of winning. They won in 1999, and then you had the Lakers win three in the 2000s, and then the Spurs won again in 04. That time in between, though, there was a team that was better. And that's why my argument is you could try and call Chicago a dynasty for winning, three out of the last six, but there were three other teams that won during that time. Two of those were the same team. It was the LA Kings. So during the time that you were ruling with this dynasty in your sport, there was another team that was just as good as you winning just the same amount. That's why I'm hesitant to call the Blackhawks a dynasty. I think you have to win consecutive titles. I think the Lakers back in the 70s and 80s, they had dynasties. The Celtics back in the 60s and 70s, those were dynasties because they won consecutive titles. Bill Russell was a part of multiple dynasties in Boston. The Bulls were a dynasty during the 90s. That's what I look at when I think of a dynasty. when the 49ers went on their run of Super Bowls, when the Cowboys had their run, when the Steelers even, those were dynasties because they won championships in succession. They might have won 4 out of 6, but they won 2 Super Bowls in succession. So to give the Blackhawks the title of being a dynasty would be, I'd have to call the San Francisco Giants a dynasty for what they've done the last the last 6 seasons. And I don't, because they won one in 2010, 2012, and 2014.
They've actually won it 3 out of 5 years, though.
So I don't want to call them a dynasty. So by the same token, I can't call the Blackhawks a dynasty because during that time, there were other teams winning at almost the same level of success. When you are a dynasty team, you are the best team during that era, and almost no one can argue with that. Some people could make the case that the Kings are the best player of this, best team of this decade, even though the Blackhawks have more Stanley Cup wins. You can make that argument. It's not a successful argument, but you can still make it. So that's why I won't be so quick to hand over the dynasty title to the Blackhawks. They're obviously a very talented hockey team. They have some of the best players in the NHL on their team, and they understand what it takes to play team hockey and win. But I think they need to win next year. They need to win back-to-back or win another title in 2 years, in the next 1 to 2 years, in order for me to give them the dynasty title. They haven't quite earned it for me yet. So enough about hockey. We'll go ahead and talk about the golf tournament this weekend. If I think some of the players would argue that what they were doing over the weekend wasn't necessarily golf because the course conditions were so poor. The U.S. Open was played out at Chambers Bay this weekend, and it's no secret that the conditions out there were terrible. Some players saying it was like, trying to putt on the greens was like putting on broccoli. You've played in some pretty poor conditions probably before, not necessarily in such high-pressure situation as a U.S. Open championship, but how how significant of an effect the quality of the course can have on play. Do you want to touch on the effect that can have a little bit?
Yeah, so what happened this week and what I was reading was the problem that they were having with the U.S. Open this weekend was the quality of the greens. And it was because the way they watered the course and the way they tried to prepare it, the USGA traditionally likes to get the greens to be very quick for the U.S. Mm-hmm. Open, which they did in some parts of the green, but that was the problem, is the green, the way they did it, they made a mistake and they managed to make the greens inconsistent in
right.
parts, which alludes to what you said, that the players were calling it like putting on broccoli.
And it was fast in some places and slow in other places.
And so it didn't make a big difference playing off the green because the ball travels mostly through the air, obviously. But when you get to the green, you need the ball to make consistent speed. Otherwise, it's hard to read putts. It's hard to figure stuff out. And I noticed, I saw, when I tuned into it yesterday, I saw one player was only about 25 yards out, and he was just trying to pitch the ball onto the green. And there was a big lip with the hole right on the front of the green.
Mm-hmm.
And he put the ball, initially landed the ball probably within about 6 feet of the hole, but the backspin kicked in, and then the green was so quick, it rolled all the way back down to where he was.
Yeah.
And when he tried it again, the same thing happened.
Same result.
He had to settle for going in the middle of the green, and it's just because the green was too inconsistent, you couldn't get a feel for it.
Right.
And that's something that will really piss players off.
Yeah. And so it was unfortunate for a lot of people. Tiger Woods played arguably the worst round of golf he's ever played in his entire life.
Yeah.
This weekend. We won't talk about Tiger too much because it's almost too depressing for me to talk about how bad he looks out there. And I don't think it's really a talent thing. I think he's mentally not all there.
Yeah.
But Jordan Spieth, who is the new future of golf, has now won the Masters and the U.S. Open. And some people are saying they don't doubt that he might be able to go for the first Grand Slam in the Masters era. He's the youngest player to ever win both the U.S. Open and the Masters in a calendar year, and he's one of just 6 players to ever do it. It's a really special moment for him. What does it mean for him and for the game of golf that he's able to have this success this early?
Well, it's fantastic for him because it puts him on pace to... I mean, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but it really helps you out when you're 21 and you've already won 2 majors. So he's
right.
on a pace to maybe be one of the best players of all time, hopefully. Mm-hmm. But for the whole of golf, it's good to see someone step up, especially a young person like him, 21 years old, to step up and try and declare himself as the best player in golf right now.
Yeah, and I think some can argue that he is. I mean, he's gone out the last 2 major championships and shown that he's the best player out there. I did think there was a funny moment yesterday, kind of go back to the course quality. Maybe it wasn't yesterday, it was Saturday. And Spieth was trying to hit out of the 18th bunker, which was treacherous. I mean, it was literally like jumping into a foxhole, it looked like. And you could see him saying that this is the dumbest hole of golf he's ever had to play. So that was interesting. It was kind of a funny moment. So with the British Open and the PGA Championship still left to play, do you think that Spieth has what it takes to win those two? Obviously, it's tough to predict winners of these tournaments because they, you know, anyone really has a chance. But is it out of the realm of possibility to believe that he can do it?
No, I think he can do it because they'll play the British Open next, and that course will actually play similarly to Chambers Bay, because I don't know if you noticed, Chambers Bay kind of looked like a European course.
Right.
There was one tree on the whole course.
Mm-hmm.
The difference will be, though, when you play over in Europe there, they have the wind is stronger, so mm-hmm. he'll be competing against that. But other than that, it'll play similarly to Chambers Bay, so hopefully there won't be that much of a transition for him trying to get his feet wet there.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm excited to see what Jordan Spieth has to offer, you know, moving forward. I'm excited to see how much more he can raise his level of play. And I'm just excited to see his kind of historic run continue. Before we talk about the HBO programming from this week, I thought it would be kind of a disservice to not talk about what the unthinkable, unspeakable tragedy that happened in Charleston last week. For those of you who don't know, and I don't know how you wouldn't know, but there was a racially charged mass shooting that occurred last Wednesday night in Charleston, South Carolina. It happened in a church in a historically segregated part of the country, as we know, in South Carolina. You know, luckily, years ago, we you know, abolished, you know, segregation laws and things like that. But not too long ago, there was a lot of racial tension and hatred in that part of the country, in that part of the world. And you'd like to think that in 2015, we've moved beyond that. And then you hear something about something like this on the news. You hear how tragically these people's lives were taken away from them. And you hear about how much hatred this, you know, young man had in his heart, the monster that he kind of was, and the unspeakable acts he committed on these people. And it makes you wonder about the state of our country and the state of how things are here. And I just... You know, a lot of people have already talked about it. You know, people that, you know, we look to in these kind of moments, at least who I look to, aren't necessarily people you typically would think. You know, obviously you look to the president in moments like this for leadership. But I think some people with the most poignant messages about this, you know, were two guys that are, you know, one is still on The Daily Show and one, you know, used to be, is John Oliver and John Stewart. And I think that they summed up a lot of things that put it in a perspective that makes it a little bit, not easier to stomach, but it puts you in a perspective where you can understand these things in a greater light. And what John Stewart has said about this is, why can't we call this what it is? This is a terrorist attack. This person committed unspeakable acts of violence to strike fear into the hearts of other people. And just because it happens here on American soil and it wasn't a terrorist attack by somebody who identifies as Muslim or who, you know, is of the Middle Eastern, you know, look, that doesn't mean it's not a terrorist attack. I think so often we get kind of blinded to what to call things like this. And it is a terrorist attack. Someone tried to instill fear in the hearts of other people through violence and through their actions. What were your thoughts on Thursday morning, kind of learning about everything that happened last Wednesday night?
Well, I feel awful because I feel like these things are so hard to prevent. And what's really hard about it is I feel like as a country, we're struggling to convince people that they need to stop judging people off of arbitrary things like skin color.
Right.
Like, that does not determine anything for anyone, really.
And for this monster that took these people's lives, for him, that something that should be insignificant to how you view somebody was the source of his hatred, and which scares me a little bit. And what also scared me and put me in this state of unease is that this coward walked into one of the most peaceful places you can imagine in this country. He walked into a church that stood as a symbol of hope and a symbol of unity in that community. The church was built to combat segregation laws at the time because there were rules, that they disagree with the rules about the burial practices of black people in that area, in that region. And he went into the most peaceful places, a place that has so much history and means so much to so many people, and forever tainted it and ruined, you know, what had been done in that community. Not ruined it, because you're going to see the strength and resolve of the people that live there rise up above this. But for a while, he has poisoned, you know, that area and that community. And I think there are things that we can do as a country and as a nation to try and help these people heal, because really, it's not about the way somebody, you know, two college-age kids in Kansas City feel about it. It's about doing things to help people in Charleston, South Carolina, to move past this tragedy, to show your support and to share your words of kindness and sympathy for what has happened. But there are things we can do as a nation, like stop raising the Confederate flag in places. There are things we can do in South Carolina, like remove the names of Confederate generals from these street signs, because those are small things, but they still serve as a constant reminder of these infrastructure that existed many, many years ago. And I think that it's a disservice to the memory of not just these you know, victims of this, but those who have lost their lives fighting segregation, fighting for civil rights. I think we need to start thinking more progressively on just even some of the little things before we can rebuild and heal as a country.
Yeah, I agree. And so your thing about the Confederate flag, I mean, have you been reading about how all of a sudden South Carolina is now in favor of taking down the Confederate flag they have in front of their Capitol building?
Right.
I'm what really just bothers me about that, which people have a right to put up whatever flag they want, but on a state property, on government property, how are you raising a flag that in its most basic sense represents a failed attempt at a nation from 150 years ago? What business does it have there? And I think what really bothered people is that the other day they lowered their flags to half staff, but the Confederate one was not moved because it's not official government flag. So it stayed up while the state flag of South Carolina and the U.S. flag were lowered below.
Right. And if you are a person in government at any level in South Carolina, how does it not compute for you common sense wise to remove that, to bring it down? Because really what it stands for, at least to me, is a symbol of hatred.
Yeah.
You can call it whatever it is, but let's call a spade a spade. It represents a dark point in this country's history. And we are now facing another dark point in this country's history. When you consider everything that has happened within the social climate of the United States, and then for this to happen now, we were too young to remember Columbine, because that happened when we were, you know, very, very young. But in my recent adult life, it seems like every three or four months, this is something that is in the news cycle, whether it's racially charged or not. But these mass shootings, while they may be hard to prevent at times, there are things we can do to prevent these people from getting their hands on weapons. I'm not going to start getting into an argument about gun control, but I really don't think there's any reason why a mentally unstable racist in the heart of South Carolina should be able to own a weapon where he can efficiently kill 9 people. And that it's terrible. That what frustrates me is that everyone tried to turn this as soon as it happened, rather than focus on the tragedy. And I know I just talked about the issue of gun control while talking about this tragedy, is that people wanted to use it as a pulpit and a soapbox to get on and talk about about people's rights to guns. And that's not really what we should be taking away from this. We really should be using this as a time to mourn the dead and to look forward to see how we can, you know, rebuild that community and rebuild our country for the future. Because I think for anyone to look inward at themselves and see how this country operates right now in terms of a social climate, I think there is a lot of room for growth and there's a lot of room for improvement. Because I think every issue today, it's taken with a grain of salt, because everything that everyone does is for like a like on Facebook, or for a favorite on Twitter, or for a retweet, or hell, even for a vote. That's the only reason politicians ever raise an issue these days, is just to swing a vote one direction. So we're not trying to open a dialogue and talk about these issues to move anything forward. We're only doing it for that 10 seconds where someone agrees with what we said. We don't want to have a discussion. We just want to post opposing arguments. There's no exchanging of words and talking about these things logically. And I think this is an opportunity for us to look inwards and say, this is a moment of tragedy. It's undeniably tragic. We need to work together as a country on both sides and say, how can we do better? How can we be better as people? How can we be better as citizens? How can we be better as countrymen? And it's just, I think moments of tragedy like this, while tragic, present opportunities for us to grow as a country. And I think that the more we talk about it, the more we allow opportunities for growth, the more we argue and bicker about it, the more it sets us back to where we used to be. And I think if you argue and bicker about, you know, insignificant things like, you know, just any of the political issues that were arisen from this, you don't really get to the heart of the matter, and that there's still hatred and there's still people desensitized to the fact that racism still exists in this country. So we don't want to bore you guys with this topic too much, because it's been almost a week and people have kind of said their piece about it, but it is something that we felt strongly about talking and touching on. So we'll move away from the Charleston tragedy and kind of get into more uplifting. Well, I guess the show itself isn't very uplifting, but True Detective premiered last night, the second season of the HBO drama, which we both fully enjoyed the first season that had, you know, the heavy hitters of Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson kind of driving the show. This season, there are four central characters. That you have Colin Farrell as a kind of rogue detective in Los Angeles. We kind of don't know too much about his character yet. You've got Vince Vaughn, who is playing an apparent mobster who's trying to kind of go legitimate with this public transit deal. You've got Taylor Kitsch, who plays this clearly very embattled highway patrolman who seems to maybe have a little bit of a death wish. And then you have Rachel McAdams playing this very interesting, very strong-willed, clearly very anti-men policewoman, who all kind of have their separate stories that come together at the end of the first episode. What were your thoughts after watching last night's premiere of True Detective?
Well, so far, I think my character that I kind of like the most might be Vince Vaughn's character, and I think that's just because I like him. You know, I like him when he's a funny guy, but I find it very interesting when he takes on like a kind of dark persona and is like, in this instance, he's kind of like a mob, which I'm not exactly sure how you're drawing so far. He's trying to go legitimate, because I know in the mob, they do semi-legitimate things sometimes so they can keep their cover going.
I think he's trying to go legitimate because I would have to imagine, well, first of all, he said in the episode last night, "I'm going legitimate," which was said in the dialogue with his wife. Two, I think when you consider what he's doing, he's going through the right channels to try and get this I don't know, light rail installed. So he's not doing any under the table dealings, at least as far as we know or have been revealed. But we do know he has a dark past, because we know that he took care of, possibly killed, the man who is believed to have raped and killed Colin Farrell's wife on the show.
Okay. Well, I will admit then that I missed the part where he did say literally he was trying to go legitimate.
Right.
It's my bad. But I'd also like to point out he did pay off Colin Farrell to go beat up that reporter. So
that's true.
Pretty shady deal paying a cop to do that.
That is true. That's definitely not legitimate business dealings.
We'll see how it goes. We won't make judgments exactly like that.
But your first impressions of the show, do you like the direction that they went this season? There's obviously less flashbacks. There's not as much philosophical overtones as there were in the first season, or at least not yet. So what was your overall reaction to the episode?
I think my reaction is that I'm very intrigued by Taylor Kitsch's character, because I want to see how he more plays into this series, because I think we saw in kind of the hierarchy of the where they work in law enforcement, he's kind of the lower end.
Mm-hmm.
He kind of only played in so far because he was the one who discovered the dead body at the end of the season or end of the episode.
Right.
So I'm interested to see how it goes, because it also showed he looks like he has some kind of problems with himself. He was doing some fairly dangerous driving.
Right. I think it's safe to say that he kind of has a death wish. I think that in reading about the character from some earlier reviews, that he's got a military background, so maybe he's suffering from some post-traumatic stress disorder. He's clearly suffering some issues with his unmentionables working in the bedroom, but that we saw that in the first episode. So maybe that's some psychological issues he's trying to manage through. I think the most interesting character for me is a tie between Colin Farrell's character, Ray Vaccaro, I believe is his name, and Rachel McAdams' character, who I won't even try to get into say her entire name, but her nickname is Annie. Or Annie, I can't quite remember. But those two seem to have, you know, equally embattled backgrounds, and I think those two seem to be the most unstable. Clearly, Colin Farrell is unstable. He called his son a fat pussy, and then he, we won't get too much into it, but he threatened to do some pretty awful things to a kid's dad because the kid bullied his son and cut up his LeBron James.
I believe I referred to that one as a all-time True Detective line.
Yeah, too. I think that was the all-time, at least most graphically disturbing line that we've heard uttered on that show. And you hear a lot of terrible things uttered on that show. So I'm excited for the next 7 episodes of True Detective. It's obviously going to be a little bit different because you don't really have the buddy-buddy rapport that, I guess not really buddy-buddy, but there's no rapport that was developed kind of the way there was between McConaughey and Harrison in the early episodes of True Detective between any of these characters yet. Maybe we will see that. I would love to see maybe Colin Farrell's character and Rachel McAdams' character work together as some sort of partner because they're not in the same departments of the Los Angeles law enforcement, but they kind of have similar overlapping duties. So I'm excited to see kind of how they evolve these characters' relationships over the course of the series because they undoubtedly will have some pretty interesting dynamics.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of interesting with the relationships real quick that from what we could tell in just this first episode that the strongest relationship is actually between Vince Vaughn, you know, the seemingly dirty businessman, mm-hmm. and Colin Farrell,
right,
on the law enforcement side, but a little dirty himself.
Right. No one's going to come out clean from this season, I feel like, and Nobody ever does. I don't anticipate this having as positive of an ending as the first season did, because the first season still kind of left you with like, oh, well, they go off and now they'll continue their lives together as friends and maybe as partners. There were two other shows on last night that I also really enjoyed. You know, Ballers, the new show starring Dwayne The Rock Johnson. We don't know a whole lot about the show yet because we're only one episode in, but there's clearly a lot in the works. Dwayne Johnson's a former defensive end for the Miami Dolphins who's trying to kind of make a career for himself in the sports management industry. His character clearly has some issues with prescription medication, trying to make sure that his body can still work after sustaining some injuries in during his football career. And he might have even possibly killed somebody on the football field. We don't really know. They haven't really established that part of his character. But there are some flashbacks that show him significantly hurting a member of the Buffalo Bills during his career. And so it kind of touches on maybe some of the darker sides of the business of, you know, the sports management agent, you know, finance relationship that these players have with, you know, their business people. And so I'm excited to see where this goes. It's kind of, I see it kind of being that guilty pleasure type show on HBO that Entourage kind of was for people, where you have the glitz and the glam, but also the dramatic element too. What were your thoughts about Ballers one episode in?
Overall, I thought the episode was good. I'm a little confused on the direction they're going with it because they did kind of mix, you know, the drama side with it a little bit, but also it was a little funny. Mm-hmm. Dwayne Johnson's boss was fairly entertaining.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think I'd like to see it be a good mix of drama and comedy, kind of like how Entourage did that, but I feel like Entourage is a little more comedy to it, too.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to, hopefully that clears up in the next episode or two, and then I can set on a direction with it. Mm-hmm. And I'm fine with the blend, too. I just was a little unsure of it this first episode.
And then the last show we watched last night was The Brink, with starring Tim Robbins and Jack Black and some other supporting characters as well. And I really enjoyed the show. I thought the structure was a little odd, but I laughed a lot, especially at Tim Robbins' character. He plays, I believe, the Secretary of State or Secretary of Defense in the cabinet. I think it was a little unclear, I think, but I believe he's the Secretary of State. And most of his scenes are occurring within the Situation Room as they try to react to an uprisal in Pakistan where there's a clearly mentally unstable leader in power. While Jack Black is over in Pakistan working at the U.S. consulate and is stuck out in the in the city while the uprising begins. So I think the show has a lot of different directions it can go after the pilot. But as long as they stay funny, I'll still watch because it was hilarious. What were your thoughts on The Brink last night?
No, I love Tim Robbins, and I think I just like the wit he kind of brought to it and mm-hmm. the way he had that kind of dry sense of humor type thing going.
Yeah.
And also Jack Black's always pretty good in anything he's been in, so I'm excited to see more of him in that.
Yeah, I'm excited to see, you know, the direction that this show goes, and I hope that this is one of those shows that gets renewed by HBO, because when Jack Black gets on screen, he's kind of this ball of energy that's hard to handle and maintain. So to close out the show, I wanted to talk about the Royals a little bit. We usually start the show talking about them, but wanted to finish with them because we did get the most recent All-Star voting today. And I'm mad because one of our guys isn't probably going to make the starting roster. And two, because I think that guy is one of the guys who actually deserves more than some of the other questionable selections to be named a starter. Now, when you can match this guy up with his competition, you may be able to make a case against him. That guy is Eric Hosmer, who's now 1.5 million votes behind the leader, Miguel Cabrera. And it doesn't look like he's going to be able to catch him before the cutoff date of the All-Star voting. However, Omar Infante increased his lead by about 140,000 votes over Jose Altuve. He's leaving Brian Dozier and Jason Kipnis both in the dust. What are your thoughts on Omar Infante still having a spot on this All-Star starting roster?
Well, it does actually surprise me that he managed to keep his spot and Hosmer lost his. I could see the fact that Hosmer lost his because I know in the last week or so, Detroit's made a huge push to get Miguel Cabrera in there. Mm-hmm. He definitely deserves it.
Right.
And I guess it is kind of annoying that Omar Infante really doesn't deserve his spot. I want him in there, but, I mean, he is, like, the worst offensive player in baseball right now.
I think the problem is that you've got a lot of guys splitting votes. I think that the obvious selection at first base is Miguel Cabrera. And then you could make an argument that maybe Eric Hosmer deserves to be coming off the bench at first base for the American League, and who knows, maybe he will. The problem you have with the second base position is that there are lots of guys that you can make a case for. You've got Jose Altuve, who's having a great season with the Astros. You've got Dustin Pedroia, who's having a really solid season with the Red Sox. You have Brian Dozier and Jason Kipnis with the Twins and the Indians, respectively, both making cases for an All-Star spot. And I think that's what's allowing Omar to get in, because the casual baseball fan is voting for one of those three guys. Royals are all voting for Omar Infante, and the rest of the people in the country who are getting behind our efforts are voting for him. So Omar Infante doesn't have to worry about splitting hairs because people aren't voting him in because he's the best second baseman. They're voting him in because they want to see an all-Royal lineup. They're voting for those other guys because they're voting, they think each one of those three are the best second baseman in the American League, and that is why I think they're all losing so significantly. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I get what you're saying. And actually, I think maybe the most interesting thing that'll come out of this All-Star voting is, I think worst case scenario where we're at right now for the Royals in terms of trying to get as many players in is that we're only going to come away with four starters, which will be the most we've ever had. But what's funny is that I think Royals fans will be disappointed if that happens.
Right.
Like, we spoiled ourselves by getting eight people into the lead halfway through the voting, so now we're setting ourselves up to be sad when we put the most players starting we've ever had.
Right. We didn't manage expectations well for this process, but because we didn't know what was going to happen. We didn't realize that this was going to be the case. We didn't know that we were going to have this many players playing the All-Star game. So I think it's time for us to kind of maybe take it down a notch in terms of what our expectations are going to be for that game on July 9th.
But keep voting.
Yeah, keep voting.
Vote Omar.
Yeah, hashtag vote Omar, hashtag vote Royal. So that concludes the show for this week. We will be back next Monday with another edition of the Built on the Border podcast. But in the meantime, I will be releasing my draft preview to go over all the picks that will happen on Thursday night. We're going to go ahead and play you guys out with a new song from one of my personal favorite bands, The Weepies. So we hope you guys enjoy this song. We hope you guys enjoy the rest of your week. We hope you enjoy the wonderful summer weather we are now enjoying, and we hope the rain stays far, far away from here. So for Tommy Watson, I'm Tommy Randolph. Have a fun, safe week out there, guys. Peace. Less appealing to be feeling like you're stealing someone else's broken heart. Do, 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 do.
This empty end was never something of your choosing. You could have won, but you were much too busy losing. You go out cruising for a bruising, an illusion that you used to cover up your broken heart. Do 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 do. Do 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 do. Hey, crooked smile. It would never work between you and I. And I know it's true. I still love you. You know I do. Do 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 do. Do 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 do. You don't try no more, but it is not because you're lazy. Without a doubt, you figure out that you are crazy. And it gets hazier the way we were. I stayed with her. I left you with another broken heart. I do, 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 do. Do, 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 do. Do, 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 do.